So one more time to summarize, we talked about system, a frame of reference. We talked about internal energy, which is the energy content inside that system. We talked about how it's distinct from this thing called enthalpy, which is a function that lets us not worry about work. So we can only focus on the raw energy difference in reactants and products as we're trying to conduct a chemical reaction. I talked briefly about this thing called a state function and contrasted with a path function, and that's what we're going to wind up with at the end of today's lecture, getting back to Hess's law. But there are two other things I need to mention before we can get there, these quantities known as entropy and free energy. So let me tackle entropy first. Entropy is usually thought of as disorder, which it is, but it's in a little more sophisticated way, it is the tendency for both matter and energy to become homogenized. Means spread out. So one example I tend to give is that if you have two chalk erasers, you clap the two erasers together and the chalk is going to spread out. That's what we're used to. Is it possible that all that chalk is going to come back and rearrange itself on an eraser afterwards? Yes, it is possible. But it will never happen in our lifetimes. For all those molecules to coordinate themselves suddenly to become to be able to come back to that initial starting place, just not likely. The same thing is effectively true of energy. If somehow you have energy concentrated in one part of your solution, that energy is going to end up spreading out. And that's what really entropy represents. That, if you try to order a system, so this is not talking about individual chemical reactions. This is something that applies to an entire solution. If you have an entire solution, then if you're trying to order it, it's going to effectively cost energy to cause that ordering. Other way around, though, is that if a process causes energy and matter to be spread out, that's what it wants to do anyways, and so it actually costs less than you think it would for that process to occur. So ordering a system or disordering a system has an energy content that's effectively associated with it, and that's what this term entropy represents. To order a system, to bring order to a system, effectively costs energy. And a system that creates disorder effectively experiences a release in energy. Another thing that I'll throw in here is that entropy is really more a phenomenon of reactions in solution and is not as much applicable, you could say, possibly, to individual chemical reactions. So because there is this cost that's effectively associated or benefit that might be associated with things either becoming ordered or disordered, we have yet one more combination function, which is called free energy. Marvin. Free energy is the raw difference, if we're talking about a chemical reaction, the raw difference in energy of a set of reactants and products adjusted for the effects of entropy. And this is an equation you've hopefully seen before. Oh, and I didn't even quote it up here, I'm sorry. Entropy is usually expressed as S, and free energy is usually expressed as delta G. So delta G is enthalpy, which we're going to just treat as the raw energy content of reaction, but adjusted for these either detrimental or beneficial effects of entropy. So if making a mess is effectively a release of energy, then entropy, that positive increase in disorder, we need to throw a negative sign in front of it in order to match our sign convention. So a system that is getting disordered, that is positive entropy. So, gosh, didn't leave myself room here. So delta S greater than zero means increasing entropy. Delta S less than zero means decreasing entropy. Common example, chemical reaction example that's often given. If you go from a liquid to a gas, the molecules become much more dispersed. That's positive entropy. If you freeze something, you're coordinating the molecules together, that's a decrease in entropy. So again, to match the sign convention for energy, though, we throw this negative sign in front of it. There is also an effect related to temperature, which not trying to get totally sidelined in a long discussion of entropy, but the hotter a system is, the more possible energy states there are, the more possible ways there are for energy to be distributed. So the effect of entropy increases, whether favorably or unfavorably, as temperature goes up. So what is really the difference between enthalpy and free energy? Enthalpy, you look at a set of reactants, you look at a set of products, and you kind of ignore what physically may be going on as those molecules react. You just look at the raw energy content of the reactants and products. That's a phrase that I'll probably end up using a lot, raw energy difference. But in real reactions, there is this entropy effect that you do have to worry about. And so once you've adjusted for it, the delta G, that really is equivalent to potential energy. Or another way to say it is the amount of energy actually available for a chemical reaction. So when you took Chem 1C, you saw that there was a relationship between this and potential in terms of an electrochemical reaction. In other words, voltage. Yes? Just get rid of the word raw then. Just say the difference in energy. In other words, not adjusted for anything else. It's just the energy difference between reactants and products. So we're not actually going to use free energy much today, because we often will be worried about just a compound's energy. And if we're talking about individual compounds and them not even reacting, then we don't necessarily worry about entropy. Or even if entropy is an effect, we can choose whether we're going to focus just on this energy difference or whether we're going to worry about how energy is spread around in a chemical reaction. Now for equilibrium also is related to potential energy, so there we must use delta G. But anytime we just say heat of reaction, that means the energy difference, which means we'll be dealing with enthalpy. So let me write that out, in fact. Heat of reaction, that's going to be enthalpy. But equilibrium, which is indirectly related to potential energy, that is going to be connected with free energy. Now that we have these terms in place, I'm going to go back to talking about just enthalpy, because it's a little bit easier to deal with. And let's formally address this thing called Hess's Law, which I said out loud on Monday, but I don't think I wrote anything down related to it. Hess's Law is the fact that the change in energy, delta H, for a chemical reaction. Depends only on the identity of the reactants and products, and not at all on how the reaction occurs. So as I stated on Monday, I'll say again that enthalpy is a state function. Because that's exactly what a state function is. That it doesn't matter how you get from point A to point B, it matters where is point A, where is point B. What kind of reactants do you have? What kind of products do you have? Another way that this sometimes is expressed is that if multiple individual reactions add up to some greater overall reaction, that the energy change in that overall reaction can be determined just by adding up all the individual reactions. Now, what I think might be useful at this point to do is show you a reaction coordinate diagram. We do need to finish with this discussion of what the word stable means, but since we're so knee-deep in Hess's law and talking about energy changes, putting pictures to that can really help some people. So, let me present the reaction coordinate diagram. Which I abbreviate RCD. A reaction coordinate diagram shows the energy of one instance of a chemical reaction as the reactants are fully converted to products. What do I mean by that? It means you don't have a mole of something reacting with a mole of something. This is really treating it as a, you could say, a molecule by molecule basis. So if I had, for example, in the lab that you did, T-pentyl alcohol reacting with hydrochloric acid to make the T-pentyl chloride, a reaction coordinate diagram would map that energy change. Now, I'm going to explain some of this just verbally because it's not something I'm going to test on. But what is this reaction coordinate? Because it ends up, in fact, being the x-axis of our diagram. So let me give you the shorter version of the story. Imagine we had two molecules that were reacting. We could try to figure out the positions of each of the atoms in those molecules. And we could calculate by a computer model, let's say, what the energy change would be if we allowed one atom to move one way and then another atom to move and another atom to move and another atom to move. And in theory, we could come up with this graph that shows all the different positions of the atoms that are possible and shows what the energy would be as we changed each one of those coordinates. But for each atom, there's an X, a Y, and a Z coordinate. And if you had, let's say, two very simple molecules, maybe each one only has five atoms. Well, that's 5 plus 5, 10, times 3. That's 30 different coordinates that you're chasing around, seeing how energy would change. Energy itself would be a coordinate on that graph. So for a 10-atom system, you'd have a 31-dimensional graph. And most of us can't think in 31 dimensions. So what we do instead is we simplify and say, imagine that a reaction follows the most energetically likely, most energetically favorable pathway of a reaction. That is the reaction coordinate. So coordinate means like position, except we're making this fake coordinate that's just following which way the reaction is most likely to occur. And I'll just say that last little bit of it in writing. So it is the most likely, the most energetically favorable. Pathway for a reaction. And let me just draw a simple reaction coordinate diagram. Some of the things in this diagram I already showed you in that overview lecture, but this is the point of coming back to revisit this topic, to explain this a little bit more fully. So energy is our y-axis, and it technically could be delta H or delta G. But if we're talking about heat of reaction, that phrase heat of reaction, that means we're dealing with enthalpy. And most of the time, therefore, we'll be using delta H as our energy scale. Your text is usually pretty good. Most texts are pretty good about labeling whether it's enthalpy or free energy that the diagram is trying to represent. So on the left, it's traditional that we put reactants. And on the right, we have products. And at any point in a simple chemical reaction, even a one-step reaction, as you start to break bonds or form bonds, there's going to be some intermediate point where you haven't quite done either yet. So if you're starting to break bonds, that means that the system is becoming higher energy because you have to add energy in to break that bond. And maybe a bond is forming, but it hasn't really done so yet. So you haven't really gotten whatever stabilization you might get. So that midpoint where you've reached the highest energy point during an individual reaction step, that's what's at the top of this diagram. It's often labeled with what's called a double dagger. It's an old typographical symbol. But that is the transition state. We can label a few important quantities on this diagram. One is, how much energy does it take to get from the reactants up to that transition state? That is something called the activation energy. E sub A for short. And it is the energy needed to reach the transition state for reaction to be possible. So as I probably said in that long introductory lecture, if you have a match, the match is not going to light all by itself at room temperature, but apply a little friction to it by striking it against a matchbox, and then the match will light up. That's because you're putting in this energy to get the chemical reaction over this transition state. And then once it's past that, then, well, what happens next depends on the reactants and products. In this case, you can see that we have a decrease in energy between the reactants and products, and that is delta H, the heat of reaction. Since Hess's law says that the energy change in a chemical reaction does not matter how that chemical reaction occurs, we could say, kind of conceptually, that the heat of reaction is the difference in energy of products and reactants. It would technically be the energy of the products minus the energy of reactants, so that if the products have less energy, we report this as a negative energy change, that energy is released during the chemical reaction. Now, how do we calculate delta H? We'll tackle another time in some more specific examples. So more generally, let's just say we know that there's this energy change that occurs. Now that we have this graph, let's talk a little bit about kinetics, and then we'll come back to stable, because this graph is our perfect introduction to kinetics. Because a chemical reaction may be composed of one or more elementary steps. Each of which will have its own transition state. So, for example, in the SN1 reaction, the versions of the SN1 reaction we've seen so far have each had three individual steps. Now, I just realized, as I am a bit distracted, I'm not pausing for questions at all. So does anybody have any questions for what I've discussed up to this point? It'll become clear, hopefully, as we get towards the end of this lecture, what the really important message of this diagram is, why or how we're going to be using this diagram in this class. So I've just said that a chemical reaction could have a sequence of individual steps. Maybe one step's a bond forming, another step's a bond breaking. Sometimes you might have both processes occurring at the same time. So let's say I wanted to reason out and figure, well, what might a multi-step diagram look like? And without worrying about the specific chemical reaction, let me just suggest this as one we may see later on. So now we still have the reaction coordinate, the most likely pathway. We're still going to be talking about energy changes, and I'm going to be doing these energy changes in terms of enthalpy. We still have the overall heat of reaction. It is still negative in this case. But now instead of just a reactant and product, I also have an intermediate, which is a chemical species that forms during reaction, but might not be isolatable. For example, in the SN1 reaction, the first step is to form a carbocation. Usually it's not possible to bottle up a free carbocation. So it is something distinct that forms while the reaction occurs. We just can't isolate it. And so that's what an intermediate would be, a stop-off point on the way to the final product. Since this has two transition states in it, it has two reaction steps. Number of transition states equals the number of reaction steps. Now, how do you draw activation energy when you've got multiple activation energies? It's always from what's just to the left of the transition state, either the reactant if you're starting at the beginning or the intermediate if you're starting from that point. You start from that energy point and go up to the transition state. Now, what's often misinterpreted is I'll see students drawing from the reactant and drawing activation energy up to the second transition state. But realize that if you're doing this chemical reaction, you're already going to be at the intermediate. And so you don't have to add that full amount of energy to get to the second transition state because you've already added it in. So it's always to just the left of the transition state up to the transition state itself. Now, where this leads into kinetics is that we have these different steps that you could say have different amounts of difficulty associated with them. We as humans, for example, why would we create things like elevators or more particularly remote controls if we didn't care about expending as little energy as possible? So chemical systems, the same thing. It's how much energy that you have to put in that's going to control a chemical reaction. And so this is where this idea of the rate-limiting step comes from. Which I'll abbreviate RLS. Which is that in a multi-step chemical reaction, the rate of reaction is normally controlled by one particular step, the most difficult, you could say, step in the sequence. Generally, it is the step with the highest activation energy. So if we're talking about rate, now I need to talk about rate laws. And we're not going to talk about method of initial rates or the integrated rate laws, the two ways that you learned in Chem 1B to take observational data and come up with a rate law. That is done in organic chemistry, but usually in a branch known as physical organic chemistry. We're not so much focused on synthesis, making new molecules. You're focused on studying how does a particular chemical reaction occur. So we're just going to jump to the end result. What is a rate law? So rate, in chemical terms, is the generally expressed as the rate of change of the concentration of a reactant versus the change of time. Now, this is not a calculus-based course, but realize that what I just wrote is technically the average rate. If you were doing this more properly, for those of you who have had some calculus, you would need to express this as a differential, which would give you the instantaneous rate. Now that I've mentioned that there's this distinction, we're just going to forget that it happened. Because what I'm really trying to show is how much concentration change is there in a certain amount of time. That's what rate is. So what factors influence rate? Well, There are two things, one of which is always in a rate expression, one of which depends on how the reaction occurs. You have this thing called the rate constant. And you have one or more, or occasionally zero, reactants that end up going in this rate law. Now, how do we know which reactants go in the rate law? Well, it turns out to be the ones that are in that rate-limiting step. That's the main reason that you did in Chem 1B that iodine clock experiment, because you were trying to determine which components actually did matter as far as influencing reaction rate. And then there's this thing called reaction order that you also were trying to determine, which we'll get to momentarily. In fact, I'll just show it here. As the exponent that order is. So only the reactants in the rate limiting step are included in the rate law. And this is sometimes a simplification, because maybe they'll have several competing steps. But in general, for simpler chemical reactions, it's going to be that one toughest step that if you can get past it, every other step in comparison is quick. So sometimes we will worry about steps leading up to the rate limiting step. And we'll say, okay, well, those happen quickly in comparison. And so you're generating all the stuff that once it gets through the rate limiting step, then the reaction just progresses. So it's the rate limiting step that's controlling the reaction rate. The other way to look at it is whatever steps come afterwards. If they have lower activation barriers, they're going to end up generally being quicker reactions. So as soon as that product that is results from the rate limiting step forms, it goes off on its merry way. So again, it's generally that rate limiting step that controls the rate of reaction. Now, what are the things that do go into this rate constant? Well, the rate constant, there is an expression that can be used to express it, which is the Arrhenius expression. And there are three factors that go into this, one of which we're hardly going to talk about. It's called the steric factor, which, since in this course you've had the term steric hindrance, it might make more sense to call it the steric factor. In other words, it represents how difficult is it physically for the molecules to coordinate geometry-wise and react. What we're instead going to focus on are these other two factors, activation energy and temperature. Before I can show you those, I have to show you this graph that my Chem 1A and Chem 1B students, you'll groan because you saw this one over and over and over again. But it's because it's so connected with kinetics. Before I even write this graph, let me present the situation I always give in describing this phenomenon. And I think I already said this out loud during that introductory lecture. So imagine that I spilled some water on the table here, and that the room, sometimes it's open, sometimes it's closed, maybe the air conditioning system's going, sometimes it's not. Temperature stays roughly constant. When I come back tomorrow, if it's just a few drops of water I spilled out on the table, would you expect that it would still be there? Yeah, even if no one cleaned it up. What is the boiling point of water? You have to say to that, what pressure? Because boiling point depends directly on atmospheric pressure. So if I say, what is the boiling point of water at atmospheric pressure? 100 degrees Celsius. Does this room ever get to 100 degrees Celsius? Then why in the world is water able to evaporate, which means in some sense it's kind of like it's boiling, but it's nowhere near its boiling point? How is that physically possible? And don't tell me it's because the wind can blow across it, because yes, that might be involved, but what's going on that those molecules still are able to escape? Well, what is vapor pressure? Bingo. That in a sample of molecules, some are going to be moving quickly, some are going to be moving slowly. And if you have enough that are moving fast enough, well, those are the molecules that could escape, for example, from the surface of a liquid. That's what causes vapor pressure. Molecular energy distribution. The other way I sometimes explain this is, imagine that you had a room. One of these days, if I get lucky and fabulously wealthy, I'm going to design one just so I can demonstrate this. Imagine you covered the entire roof of that room with racquetballs or something else that's really bouncy. And you had a button where you could release all of those balls at once. Right. Well, not with you in the way of them, of course, but... Point being that at that one moment, all of them would be moving roughly at the same velocity. They're all going to be headed down, and if you could release them perfectly in unison, they should all drop at the same time. But as soon as they hit the floor, they're going to start bouncing around all over the place. And when they do, they're going to adjust and end up with a distribution of speeds. Temperature itself depends on a set of molecules having an energy distribution. Quite technically, if you have a set of molecules, all of which are moving at exactly the same speed, there's no calculatable temperature. There's a calculatable energy, you could say, but temperature is based on this idea that there's always a distribution of molecular energies. And that's what this diagram that you see, or some of you have seen me so often draw in the past, represents. I'm going to change colors here, and I apologize. I'm going to do this blue, because I'm done, going to then do another one in red. In this diagram, the y-axis is the number of molecules, and the x-axis would be the energy per molecule. And the statement I would say is that at any temperature, there is a distribution of different molecular energies. Caused by the constant collision of molecules with each other. Yes. What causes what?
The molecule, like,
yeah. Kinetic energy. Temperature itself is kinetic energy. So the fact that you have a molecule that has movement, that is temperature. To have temperature means you've got kinetic energy.
So molecule always...
Unless you are at absolute zero, then molecules technically can always wiggle or vibrate. Even in solids, if you look at a solid, and you can really zoom in, there's molecular motion there. It's just very constrained. That's why it's a solid. But if you get something that's kind of a odd case like glass, Now, I've had arguments with people before about whether glass is a solid or glass is a liquid, because technically, glass over long periods of time can flow. That means there is some molecular motion that goes on. So even though it's a solid, that doesn't mean it's entirely immobile. So temperature is kinetic energy. And because these molecules are constantly bumping into each other, you're going to have different kinetic energies no matter what temperature you're at. So at higher temperatures, the distribution becomes broader. But here's what I really want to focus on. That let's say that we have an activation barrier. We have an activation energy. Well, at low temperature, there's only a small number of molecules that are going to have the energy to be able to react. Increase the temperature, the distribution shifts higher. More energy, more temperature, the two go together. So you have a much larger fraction of molecules that would be able to pass over this activation barrier. So that's why temperature is one of the variables that goes into the Arrhenius expression. At higher temperature, a larger fraction of molecules would have the energy to pass over a transition state, for example. If you call it heat of evaporation, you could say that, okay, if molecules have that much energy, they'll evaporate. So at room temperature, imagine the blue diagram, only a small fraction of molecules can escape, which is why at room temperature, it does evaporate, but it takes forever. Higher temperature, more molecules with that energy, more evaporation. Now, a very similar diagram. If you are talking about just being at one temperature, but you talk about two different activation barriers, a lower barrier and a much higher one. Let's say they were two different activation barriers for a particular chemical reaction. Well, the low barrier, you're going to have many more molecules that would have the energy to pass over. At higher temperature, very few molecules would have that energy. So if we're looking at number of molecules, the energy per molecule, then we could say at the same temperature, a higher activation energy will result in fewer molecules able to reach the transition state. And along that same line of reasoning, if we ignore the steric factor, and if we're comparing individual reaction steps that are all happening at the same temperature, then that's why the rate limiting step is... Oh, wait, I already wrote that before, didn't I? Yes, I did. It's the one with the highest activation energy. Why is concentration itself found in these rate laws? Well, more molecules floating around, more collisions, more chance for a chemical reaction to occur. Maybe I should write that down. Concentration of the reactants in the rate limiting step affects rate because the greater the concentration, the greater the chance for a successful molecular collisions. Yes?
That's right. Well, actually, no. Yes. I'm sorry. For an overall reaction, when you're writing the rate law, yes, the activation energy would be corresponding to the one that is the rate limiting step. Now, we're kind of low on time, so let me just briefly tie this back to that SN1, SN2 lecture, because we have this idea of reaction order. Which is really the number of molecules participating in an individual reaction step. If you have first order, that's really saying the same thing as unimolecular, which means only one molecule involved. Second order, which we call bimolecular, is for two molecules. And third order, termolecular, is when three molecules are involved. It's somewhat unusual to have more than that number of molecules, because it would be hard for all of them to physically coordinate in space at the same time. So we're generally limited to talking about first, second, third, or sometimes zero-order processes, although that will be kind of rare for us in OChem. So if you would refer back to the notes, and I'll come back and summarize this when we do hit SN1 and SN2. Today we're focusing on kinetics, to them for me to briefly tie back to SN1, SN2. In a week or two, when we talk about SN1 or SN2, I'll look back at today's lecture and say, well, since in the most difficult step for SN2, two molecules are involved at the same time, that's why it's called SN2. That's why it's called a bimolecular reaction. And that for SN1, since it's multi-step, but only one of those is the most difficult step, then that's why it's called unimolecular, because in that most difficult step, only one molecule is involved.